Hi there, fellow internet consumer. Has your grandma ever died because an article online convinced her that her dementia medicine was made of nanobots? Did an AI video of a man hugging a shark convince your friend to get himself eaten? I know I have. And that's why we started this podcast. Welcome to What Is True. We know you're drowning in information every day, and fake AI videos, and fake articles, and who knows what other kind of horrendous disinformation. I'm Alexa Battler.
And I'm Chris Garbutt. Together, we're going to talk about the ways facts get twisted, about the tools we can use to spot those twists, and why this matters for everyone from a teenager scrolling TikTok to a retiree checking the news over morning coffee.
Each episode this season, we'll sit down with Nina Vereshchagin and Diane Zur, the best people we could find to help us answer this question. They're two media literacy experts from Saskatchewan Polytechnic. They've spent pretty much their whole careers helping people cut through the bullcrap, and they co-authored the open source textbook, Disinformation, Dealing with the Disaster, a fantastic resource, which is how we found them, and one that we'll reference throughout the season and that you can access for free along with their course on media literacy online.
This problem keeps evolving. Our goal is to map that evolution and give you practical ways to stay ahead.
Each week, Nina and Diane will help us break down real-world situations, highlight real tools from their book you can use in your everyday life, and point you towards free resources you can start using right now to stop being lied to.
No lectures, just straight talk about what you can actually do when a story makes you pause, when an emotion spikes, or when you're tempted to share.
It's the information age, baby, and it's an age when it's harder than ever to figure out what is true. So here's our best crack at an answer. Chris, do you remember the Spanish flu? Were you there?
Alexa, I might be older than you, but yes, I know about it.
You weren't there.
I was not there, no.
Good, because it sounded terrible. For those who don't know, in 1918, over the course of a year, right off the heels of the Great War, because the Lost Generation just really could not catch a break, the deadliest pandemic of human history ripped through the world, and they called it the Spanish flu, but it actually most likely originated in America. But the whole reason it's even called the Spanish flu is because Spain was one of the only countries that was being honest about their infection numbers and how bad they were. And a lot of other countries were repressing them because right off the heels of the war, they didn't want to look weak in front of their enemies. But Spain was neutral, so they didn't care. And it made it look like Spain was this huge epicenter, but everywhere was a huge epicenter. And doctors knew this. They knew this flu was incredibly contagious. And this did actually also include media manipulation. There was a massive rally in 1918 in Philadelphia when the medical community and the city's public health director was like, hey, don't go to a rally, you'll get sick and die. And editors of the newspapers refused to publish it. 12,000 people died of the flu due to this super spreader event. So all this to say, I'm so glad that we learned our lesson. And I see no parallels at all between back then and in recent history, even a little bit.
I can't think of a similar thing.
No, we learned our lesson. Anyway, I'm here again with Nina Vereshchagin and Diane Zur, our experts on false information. We're in the first chapter of your textbook on navigating disinformation, which is once again your free guide to learn about how to stop spreading misinformation yourself and how to identify disinformation. You talk about the history of disinformation because none of this is new. And when you look back, this tool, disinformation as a tool, has been used in much the exact same way throughout history. So why though discuss history in the first place?
I'm going to very badly paraphrase the same, but it's like if you don't know history, you're bound to repeat it. As we've seen, disinformation has been around forever. Especially, I think the thing that's happened most often in the past that we could easily identify as propaganda, but we see those same things happening even today. It's like it's human nature, right? If we disparage someone else, then it makes us look better. But we've always known that you can't believe everything, right? You have to bring some critical thinking to the situation.
What are the biggest differences now in the internet age compared to what people had in an old school classic disinformation campaign?
There's 10 billion times more of it.
There is a time where you could see it was obvious if it was misinformation or disinformation, because it wasn't that good. But now with AI and other tech supports, you can make things look really good. Like deepfake videos often look as good as real video, so it's harder to tell the difference. But I think the tools, just taking your time and thinking about things and critically thinking about them and asking questions, I think that would serve anyone at any point in history.
And so you, Diana, are comparing like the early internet age to now when you're talking about it getting more sophisticated. I would also make the argument that like pre-internet, it would have been harder for people to identify false information and find evidence against it. For the same reason that people are able to create it, people are now able to refute it because we have so much information at our fingertips. Whereas back in, you know, the Roman times or the medieval times or whatever, it was just the whoever was in charge sort of told you what was true and you believed it or you didn't. There wasn't really much you could do.
I think also the whole idea of repetition, where you tell a lie enough times, it can just seem true because it's in the conversation so much. And that's been true throughout history as well. The internet just like turned that up to, you know, a million miles an hour. So I guess it's the same tactic, isn't it, is to try to slow it down. And, you know, the old saying, don't believe everything you read, is definitely a pre-internet. And so is that same tactic, I guess, you know, slow down, think about what you've read.
I think it's probably like confirmation bias. Once you know it exists, you can see it happening. But that's the key, is like, you need to know it exists, right? So if you keep hearing something over and over, even if you know it's not true, it starts to sound true. And I don't know if there's an easy way to get around it.
I have a question for Nina. Is disinformation always necessarily bad?
Disinformation is always bad because disinformation is the attempt to manipulate people for bad reasons. Misinformation or other types of false information are not necessarily always backed with an ill intent. Sometimes there's like a cuteness behind it or something, which is what I think this example that I could talk about that has to do with carrots might underlie. We'll let the listeners decide if this example is an example of bad false information or not. Does that sound okay? Because I think some people are going to think that, oh, this is fine. And other people are going to think like, that's terrible. So let me ask you all a question. Have you ever been told that if you eat your carrot, it will improve your eyesight?
Believed it all my life.
You heard from some librarian recently?
Yeah. I think it's something my grandma used to say. It's something that has sort of like gone through the generations. And even my children have said to me, you know, who are 6 and 8, you know, if I eat enough carrots, my vision will get better. So let's look at the, so this is kind of a myth that has been ongoing for, gosh, what is the date? 2025? When was the war? 70 years ago?
80.
Oh, I wanted to say 50 years ago because I'm one of those people who is always in the, it's always 2000, but, you know, so 10 years ago is 1990.
Feels like just yesterday.
30 years ago is 1970. Like, no, it was like 80 years ago now. So do carrots improve your eyesight? Let's first look at the facts. And this comes from the Mayo Clinic, which is a reliable health information source online. I recommend it to people who like to self-diagnose and look things up online. Mayo Clinic is a good one to look at. So the facts are that carrots contain a good amount of beta carotene, which when it gets into the body is converted to vitamin A, which helps to maintain eye health. A vitamin A deficiency can lead to eye issues or lots of other health issues, actually. So you could lose some vision if you had an extreme vitamin A deficiency. So in like low income countries where there's a lack of nutrient dense food, you do have situations where there are children or pregnant women is another common population that this affects, who might suffer from something in layman's terms referred to as night blindness. And so these are people who are deficient in this, and it does affect their vision. And so if they were to get those vitamins and those nutrient dense foods back into their diet effectively, and it doesn't just come from carrots, it comes from lots of other sources, they would reverse that. It doesn't go the other way around, though. Like, if you're already a healthy person and you already have a reasonably healthy, balanced diet, you have glasses, and you're like, oh, I'm going to eat like 20 pounds of carrots a week because it's going to improve my vision. It doesn't work that way. Like, it's not going to improve your vision or help you see in the dark. So what we're talking about here is an example where a fact is sort of like stretched and a rumor seed is planted and then it takes off and then it lasts for, in our case here, 80 years. The roots of this particular rumor can be traced back to World War II propaganda in Great Britain, where the Ministry of Information popularized the carrot myth as... There's two different ideas of why they did this. So do you want to hear them both?
Yes. Yeah.
Of course.
Great. Okay. So I'm going to start with a little bit of context. So there is... From 1940 to 1941, there are lots of blackouts happening in Great Britain because there are nighttime air raids from the German army. And so the information I'm about to give you, the theories, come from the Smithsonian Museum, who spoke with a curator from the World Carrot Museum, sorry, the Virtual World Carrot Museum. It is a well-researched article that points to many reliable sources, including... And as I'm about to say this, I know that our journalism episode is coming up. I'm wondering if I'm going to say reliable sources like the New York Times and then give Alexa and Chris a questioning glance.
I mean, they're full of good journalists. So.
Right. Okay. As I was taking notes, I was like, is that a reliable source? I don't even know anything anymore. Welcome to our world of false information.
Welcome to the world of disinformation.
Yeah. So anyway, it's backed by articles from the New York Times, backed by the Scientific American, some articles from BBC. There's articles in McGill University website. Like, there's just all of these different people who back these theories. Okay, so theory one, carrots making your eyesight better. So in the early 1940s, the British Air Force starts using aircraft perception radar, which helped them detect the German planes before they got into certain territory. This is during these like Luftwaffe raids. The story goes that in order for Great Britain to hide that their pilots were using this like new technology of radar to shoot down German planes, that actually they were able to see in the dark because they were eating so many carrots. And so that's why they were able to shoot down German planes. There is even an example of a pilot whose name was John Cunningham, whose nickname was Cat Eyes, and he was the first British pilot to shoot down a German plane using the radar. Very, very successful after that. Like, he shot down 20 planes and 19 of them were at night. So he became this like superhero you see on posters who like has such great vision because he's eaten so many carrots. So there's this theory that the British government started these rumors and they wanted the Germans to hear about it and think that this is why they were able to shoot down planes, and then hopefully, ha ha ha, those Germans would like be stupid and eat a bunch of carrots too and not like pay attention to what's actually happening. Historians say that it's unlikely that the Germans believed this. They say they probably knew about the radar. This is probably like a pretty far-fetched theory. There's definitely some truth though to these images or these posters or these propaganda campaigns of pilots eating a lot of carrots and becoming these like super sighted heroes. And that kind of leads into theory two. So theory two, I'm going to begin by describing a poster from the Imperial War Museum. It's a propaganda poster. And it's a poster that is a mother clutching a child and peering across a dark street with a very worried look on her face. And the caption reads, "Carrots keep you healthy and help you see in a blackout." So as the war continued, food supplies in Great Britain were diminished. Things like bacon, sugar, and butter were really hard to get. And so the government starts to encourage people to grow victory gardens. And so victory gardens, they're growing like root vegetables, like carrots and potatoes and beets and stuff like this. And they start to develop marketing materials to encourage people to do this. And so we have characters that come out. We have a mascot called Dr. Carrot, and we have a Potato Pete. And they become really popular, and like kids get really excited about them. Dr. Carrot becomes particularly popular. He has a whole family. He has a whole carrot family. And, you know, they talk about the benefits of eating carrots. So this campaign is such a success that by the year 1942, Great Britain has 100,000 tons of surplus carrots. And so the government needs to get people eating these carrots. And so they did more things. Like, they had people regularly tuning into radio broadcasts. One was called The Kitchen Front, and it's a BBC program that provided cooking tips and recipes. And they gave the British people, you know, ideas for sweet treats that were appealing because there was no sugar, or sugar was in very low supply. It wasn't really available to them. They gave them ideas for carrot puddings, carrot cakes, carrot marmalades, carrot flans, all featuring carrots as their main ingredients, and all with that underlying message of you're going to be able to see in the dark, or you're going to get improved vision if you keep eating these carrots. So I guess my question is, scientists and ophthalmologists and dieticians and all of those people have proven that it doesn't actually improve your eyesight, but carrots, eating them, is good for your overall health. So was this a harmful campaign?
Yeah, I don't know. The Victory Garden idea, that one makes more sense to me. Like, when I see stuff like this, I should probably explain, like, my thinking does. So I'm like, okay, if I was in history, what would be my most likely reason? If I'm trying to get people to believe that carrots are good for your eyesight, why would I be doing that? And my first thought is, oh, I have too many carrots. I need people to eat them. So that's why I think the Victory Garden one makes more sense. Did it hurt anyone? I don't know. Did someone eat so many carrots they actually turned orange? Is that a thing? Is that even a real thing? Is it possible?
What makes flamingos pink?
Ooh. So, did it hurt anybody, or is it just alarming that a government can control the message in such
a narrative that much
intense way?
Well, is that not the same as the Got Milk campaign? Like, that's just advertising that milk exists. Hey, there's milk. I don't care where you get it from, but there is milk. Is that not, that had something to do with government surpluses or boosting local farmers?
Yeah,
or...
I think it's like to do with dairy, right? Because dairy is very local. And if you can sell it locally, it makes that too makes more sense, right? Because transporting milk, you've got a limited amount of time and you can't send it around the world very easily, right? So it's very much a thing in Canada where it's okay, yes, we produce milk locally, so it'd be really great if lots of people drank a lot of it locally. Same idea.
Wonder if it would have been just as effective to say, hey everyone, we have too many carrots. We need to eat them.
Right.
And then my mind is going to a dark place of like, I'm imagining like a child in the air raid thinking they can see in the dark and like running through alleys or something and getting harmed. Like, this is the first time I've thought about this negatively.
I wish we could like go back and see if people believed it. Like, just among, okay, so all four of us have heard this, right? But has your carrot eating habits changed with this knowledge? I'm eating as many carrots as I would at any other point. And I do eat a lot more carrots when they're ready from gardens, because that's just the way it goes.
I think it's likely I've eaten more carrots because of it.
It makes sense that that would even be where this ridiculous notion of carrot cake comes from. Like, who wants vegetables with their cake? What other vegetable? And then they were
zucchini.
Let's do cheese.
Zucchini loaf,
it's all marketing.
I mean, Diane, you had a good current example that connects to this that is like similar misinformation.
Yeah, so I see a lot of parallels between carrots and vitamin C. Again, same sort of thing where like vitamin C is not bad for us. We do need vitamin C. It's important, but there are those like vitamin C drinks or vitamin C powders. Very recently, I saw one marketed to kids that like a vitamin C like tip back. What, like those yogurt things almost. And the way they are marketed is vitamin C is going to prevent colds or help you get over colds, or it's going to keep you healthier. But there has been research done on this. And in particular, I was looking at a systematic review. And the reason I really like those is that they pull a bunch of journal articles and studies together and then determine whether or not they can come to some sort of conclusion. So they're taking as much science as they can find and seeing if there's a definitive answer here. So with the systematic review, what they said about these vitamin C supplement things is that they don't prevent colds. That doesn't work. And there's very limited evidence that they can shorten a cold. Sometimes, but it would only be like maybe 2 days. So even if you're taking all this vitamin C, the best result is you might be sick a little bit shorter. But the ultimate result is probably just expensive urine because your body just flushes it out.
So it's like a money-making thing, whereas the carrots, from our examples, perhaps there's other things that we're missing here, but from our examples, it's an oversupply, and so we're trying to get rid of it. But what you're talking about is actually profit gaining for companies.
For sure.
And it's the same kind of thing. It's like we take this fact and then we stretch it to fulfill whatever goal we're trying to achieve. And that's often what you see in misinformation online, is someone takes a fact and tries to change it to whatever they want it to be for their gain in some particular way.
Well, I don't know if this expression is common. It's just something I've heard and kept close my whole life, is that for every rumor, there's a kernel of truth. And I feel like misinformation is the same thing. Misinformation and disinformation works really well if there's just the tiniest little drizzle of truth in there. Then it makes it,
totally.
Just makes it believable, more believable.
And say that's what you should do if you're trying to convince someone that you're not lying, is to make a little bit true, a little bit of truth in there. So way back when, let's say, Big Carrot was clearly pushing its narrative in post-war era, how would they have been able to figure out whether that was true?
Yeah, so this ties in what Nina was saying. The average citizen might not have known whether or not it's true, right? Like, generally, people would have a little bit of trust in their governments and so would think that what they're saying is accurate. And so you might believe it unless you're like talking on the street with someone. And if you could go around asking everyone what their experience is and then get a big enough sample size that you're like, oh, hey, yeah, this doesn't actually work. But I don't think that we do that. We would just probably believe it.
Well, and you'd have to think about like where were reliable sources at that time. Like, would you need to visit the government information building? Would you visit the library? And who has the knowledge or the resources to do that outside of academics and scientists and stuff like that? So I think your access to the accurate information would be very limited.
At that time, you would definitely have some sort of paper. But if they choose not to cover that, and why would they? It's wartime. You're not going to be like, hey, let's disprove this carrot theory. It's no, we've got bigger problems.
They're too busy posting cartoons of Dr. Carrot. Like,
they're probably selling more papers that way.
Yeah. But no, like people didn't have access to information like we do now. Just truly.
Is it then also, though, fair to say whatever information you did come across was probably more likely to be true because it was more of a pain in the ass to produce any kind of information back then?
I mean, in this example, I think in wartimes, countries publish whatever they want to achieve whatever goal they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, well.
You're the journalist. You'd have to tell me if news is normally considered true and normal.
Depends where you are.
Thanks for listening to What Is True. Remember, when something makes you gasp, pause, check the source, and think before you share. And keep your hippos in the imagination, not the kitchen cabinet.
Just next week for another deep dive with Nina and Diane. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and ring that bell so you never miss another truth bomb.